Welcome to the May-June edition of the NOG Podcast. In this episode, we begin with a conversation featuring Ryan Elmos, Commercial Vice President at Ardent Mills, who shares an update on the current state of flour production. Next, we catch up with Aaron Harries, Kansas Wheat's Vice President of Research and Operations, to discuss the Wheat Quality Council's annual Hard Red Winter Wheat Tour and the insights it provided into this year's crop. We wrap up the episode with the National Wheat Foundation's Chairman, Scott Brown, who reflects on this year's farm tour held at the Spates Farm in Poolesville, Maryland, and highlights the importance of connecting policymakers with wheat farmers. I'm here with Ryan Elmos. How are you doing, Ryan?
I'm doing well. How are you?
Great. It's great to have you here today to talk to us about Ardent Mills and what, you know, the biggest shifts you're seeing right now in wheat product in flour production.
Thanks, Elizabeth. My name is Ryan Olmos. I'm a commercial VP at Ardent Mills, and I have 20 years of experience in the grain processing industry, with the last 16 being in the flour milling industry. I spent over a decade in various trading roles for Ardent Mills kind of across North America, where I got to spend time working with growers and managing people that contracted directly with growers. And now in this commercial role, I take my trading roots and I work with our sales team and customers to connect the entire supply chain from wheat to the North American consumer. So trying to be that one commercial voice between farmers and consumers. On top of that, I have the opportunity to operate my family farm in South Dakota, along with my dad and my uncle. And Ardent Mills was very gracious to me post-COVID. They let me move back. So I live about 3 miles from the farm that I grew up on my grandparents' property. And so I think that's really helping given me a different perspective at Ardent Mills to understand what farmers are looking at, because I'm literally one at night and on the weekends and doing things with them. And that dual perspective, working closely with farmers in my corporate role and being one myself, is really what has kept me at Ardent Mills and why I love what I do. And I think most of your listeners know, but just to give a little bit of background about Ardent Mills is a joint venture between Cargill, ConAgra, and CHS, and it was formed in 2014. I've had the privilege of being here since formation, and today we're the largest domestic user of U.S. wheat with nearly 30% share. We connect the full supply chain from farmer to consumer, supplying industries across food, retail, and animal nutrition, and producing products that feed over 100 million people daily.
Thanks for giving us that introduction. So from Ardent Mills' perspective, what are the biggest shifts you all are seeing right now in wheat demand and flour production? And what should wheat growers be thinking about those trends heading into the next few growing seasons?
Yeah, there's basically two main sources of demand for wheat. There's export and there's domestic. Let's quickly hit the export one, right? There's basically three factors that we see that have contributed to U.S. export demand being lower the last, and I would even say this goes back quite a while. I mean, even, you know, 10, 15 years, we've been slowly losing it kind of over my career, right? And I think there's three main factors that have done that. One is just the high relative value of the U.S. dollar. It's a relative value indicator. So the higher the U.S. dollar, the more expensive our goods are in the world. The second being higher relative transportation costs. So you think about things like where the major demand for export or for imported wheat rather in the world is kind of North Africa and the Middle East. And it does cost more in transportation for U.S. wheat to get there versus other major producing origins like the Black Sea, like Europe. Right. And then kind of the third thing is just we've seen generally more profitable crop alternatives for farmers. Right. So as wheat acres continue to go down, all else being equal, the price of wheat goes up. Right. And then that just creates the overall price combined with the other two factors to be higher. And we just kind of have this cycle where there's just been better alternatives for farmers, right? And all of that leads to just lower U.S. export demand for wheat. On the domestic side, the story, there's basically three factors that go into that as well, right? And I think the first of which is consumer preferences and health trends. The second is policy regulation. And the third is economic volatility. Right. And those three things have combined to hit a 15-year low in flour demand. The first, I think, when we think about consumer preferences and health trends, one of the biggest things that we see driving this today is the GLP-1 adoption rate. Right. Remember, these are the drugs that were originally designed for type 2 diabetes, but we've seen a lot more people use them kind of for weight loss recently. And when you take them for weight loss, you literally just consume less calories. And at flour, it seems to be hit a little bit disproportionately hard on those. So some of the categories that those users eat less of tend to be higher flour containing categories. The second, as we said, is kind of the regulation and MAHA movement, and things like the FDA's new dietary guidelines. I think those have really impacted us. State by state, it's a little bit differently. But when you think about SNAP and school lunch programs, those tend to be very, again, high flour consumption areas that have some different regulations and have negatively impacted the overall flour demand. And lastly, just broad economic volatility. As the farmers that listen to this know, we're seeing tighter household budgets, right? Just they are impacting overall food consumption, and we're seeing people just take a more tradition, a more intentional approach to their grocery shopping, and making fewer impulse buys, right? So just sometimes the cart is literally just smaller than it has been previously, right? So flour demand isn't going to be immune to those factors either. So like I said, compounded, we did hit a 15-year low in flour demand. One of the things that we like to look at as Ardent Mills and the broader flour milling industry is the capacity utilization rate. This is the rate that really looks at how hard are flour mills running. And the way the USDA calculates that is based on a 6-day run rate. So you basically take the capacity of the flour mill and multiply that by 6 days a week. And that if you are running that amount, you're running at 100%. And recently the USDA's latest report had us running about 85%. And that is well below the 3 and 5 year average, which makes sense given the demand scenario that we just talked through, right? We just have less demand, and there are a few less flour mills, but we've seen demand come down faster than supply has. But I would pause there. There is some room for optimism too. It's not all negative. And one of the things that we're really seeing is retail flour continues to be very resilient, right? That's anything that's packed or bagged on a retail flour shelf. And as far as we can tell, even out in the calendar year 27, it looks like that category is going to be doing okay. And it tends to be buoyed, in these tougher economic environments. It tends to be cheaper to cook at home than it is to buy elsewhere. And I think thus far we're absolutely seeing the consumer act in that way. I think the last couple of things that I would really hit on, this past 12 months or so, one of the things that we've really been tracking are wellness claims. Right. And you think about when you wellness stacking, we call it, where you can maybe get multiple different wellness factors on a product, that's really been growing. So think about high fiber and high protein in products. Those launches are up 6% in the last year. And we tend to see some whole wheat products when be involved in those when those claims are made. Right. And so as we continue to see these shifts play out in the market, the opportunity for wheat farmers as we see it is just to be very proactive, meet demand where it's going and lean into what consumers want.
So I know Ardent Mills has been closely tracking this as well as us. As you know, input costs and supply chain disruptions has been a major theme over the past few years in agriculture. Have those pressures changed the way Ardent Mills has worked with wheat growers or sources of grain?
Yeah, the short answer is that they absolutely have. And I think we'll get into some details here. And I don't want to come across as input costs aren't new, as we all know that this has always been a consideration. What I think is new though is the volatility in the input costs. And I think right now, let's just take the price of oil, right? And we just look at what's happened over the last few months. I mean, most world economists would describe oil as the lifeblood of the world. And it's not uncommon to see a 10% move in the price of oil on any given day. And so there's obvious impacts to that when we go to the gas pump or the diesel pump and seeing it cost significantly more than it has. But I think a lot less people understand the trickle-down effect of that. And you think about what fertilizer costs, what chemicals costs, what it costs to process things, what the energy costs. Oil is a key contributor to all of those things. And so based on the various calculus involved in changing inputs for farmers, right now, there's no one statement I can say that will apply blanket to all of the North American wheat growers. But I think it's been interesting, even though wheat acres are down in total because of these input changes, we actually see regions where wheat acres are growing, right? Wheat tends to be a lower input cost commodity versus corn and soybeans, and it, but it tends to, there's times that it is lower revenues as well. But I think for some farmers that don't want to have all the risk in there, the wheat as a rotation has actually gained some acres. Again, that won't be true everywhere, but I think it's been very interesting for us to watch how that's played out. And just like farmers, as Ardent Mills, we're changing our inputs, right? And how we look at things too. And even though we've had to make some tough choices and close some flour mills because of the demand being lower, as I described a few minutes ago, we're also reinvesting too, right? We look at we made a major investment in our Commerce City, Colorado flour mill that really services the Mountain West and in Front Range regions, and we've seen incredible growth there, and needed more capacity to satisfy that growth. And so I think, in investments such as this really help us stay just resilient through supply disruptions, maintain a steady supply, and strengthen how we work alongside wheat growers. So I want the wheat growers to understand that the decisions that they're thinking about and they're making on their own, Ardent Mills is having to evolve and do things differently as well. And I think when kind of the last part of your question, when we discuss supply chains, I think it's very important to note that the world views North American wheat as the most stable and reliable in the world, right? And if we go back and we think about, times of economic or global uncertainty, I'm thinking about COVID, thinking about the start of the Russian-Ukraine war. These times of uncertainty seem to bring demand to the U.S. wheat market, whether that's real or perceived, right? I think that sometimes the market goes up really fast and we never actually see that demand happen. But I think it's really important for growers to be watching these inputs, seeing what's happened in the geopolitical marketplace. And these do present opportunities to market their grain. And I think the farmers that we've seen be the most successful are the ones that have their input cost strategy tied together along with their marketing, right? And you gotta the market has been given the opportunity, and I know it can be frustrating when they're geopolitical events that cause this instead of kind of the more normal supply and demand, but it is all opportunity for farmers. And I think as we look ahead, the ones that can really take advantage of that are the ones that have been the most successful the past few years, and we expect that to be the case moving forward as well.
You mentioned earlier the MAHA movement. Wheat really has been, drawn into that conversation a lot. How, if at all, has this movement influenced Ardent Mills' product strategy, customer demand, or just relationships with growers in general?
Yeah, as I mentioned earlier, MAHA is one of the several factors influencing consumer preferences and contributing to softer flour demand. It extends beyond the consumer and directly impacts the school lunch programs and SNAP benefits, just as we talked earlier. And those are really, really important demand drivers when you think about whole wheat and some of these other categories. We have seen a disproportional drop in demand in a couple of these categories, specifically because of these movements like the MAHA movement. These changes can reduce our operational efficiency. They increase our cost to serve. They are also influencing how certain foods are prioritized or funded, which has implications for overall demand, right? In calendar year 27, we are definitely seeing a drop in categories like sandwich bread and snack products that offer lower nutritional value, right? Emerging policy and regulatory changes are definitely creating added complexity. Definitions of what is considered healthy or safe is evolving, and we're trying to figure that out just as growers, right? It's changing every day, right? And I would say we do have some growth areas too, though. I want to call these out, and I think some of the areas that we've seen are sourdough breads. Organic flour has definitely been growing, and products that support the high nutrient density, just as we talked earlier, have absolutely been growing. And to help meet some of this demand, we changed our process. We've evolved, and we recently acquired a Richardton, North Dakota facility, which processes specialty grains like chickpeas. And that's an investment that allows us to better support our customers while also recognizing that many of the wheat farmers we partner with are diversifying their operations as well and growing different products. So lastly, we believe industry collaboration remains critically important. Trade associations such as NOG help us ensure a strong, unified voice as we engage, educate, and advocate. There's a real opportunity here to engage constructively and help ensure nutrition, affordability, and access remain central to the conversation. That includes showing up through policy engagement, industry forums, and our day-to-day work across the value chain.
Today, I'm joined by Aaron Harries, Vice President of Research and Operations for Kansas Wheat. Aaron was born, or Aaron, sorry, let me just start over. Today I'm joined by Aaron Harries, Vice President of Research and Operations for Kansas Wheat. Aaron has been with Kansas Wheat since July 2006. Before joining Kansas Wheat, he spent around 10 years with the Kansas Grain and Feed Association, where he also worked with the Kansas Agribusiness Retailers Association, the Kansas Certified Crop Advisor Program, and the Kansas Association of Ethanol Processors. Raised on a diversified crop and dairy farm in Northeast Kansas, Aaron earned a degree in agriculture communications from Kansas State University and spent his career helping advance Kansas agriculture and the wheat industry. Aaron, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
So Kansas Wheat recently helped the Wheat Quality Council put on its annual Hard Winter Wheat Tour. For listeners who may not be familiar with it, can you explain what this tour is, who participates in it, and what makes it such an important event for the wheat industry?
Sure. The wheat tour that the Wheat Quality Council hosts, they actually do a couple of tours, the winter wheat tour in Kansas in May, and then they do a spring wheat tour in North Dakota in July, of course. But the one we're talking about, the winter wheat tour in May, is really a chance for anybody with an interest in the wheat industry to get boots on the ground out into the wheat fields, look at the condition of the wheat crop in Kansas, parts of Nebraska, parts of Oklahoma in the month leading up to harvest. So, on any given year, we can have anywhere from 40 to we've had as many as 110 people, and they come from all walks of life in the grain chain, whether that's farmers, millers, bakers. We get some international buyers. This year, we had some from Mexico and Venezuela, food companies around the United States, like Smucker's, companies like General Mills. And it truly is a group from all over the United States who travel to Kansas. And for 3 days, we're really focused on wheat, traveling together in cars, carpooling across the state for 3 days, stopping randomly at wheat fields, going out into the fields and measuring yield estimates. And at the end of the tour, we kind of get together and put together a number of what we think crop production is going to be in Kansas.
So, as you mentioned during this event, you spent several days traveling across Kansas evaluating your wheat fields. What were the biggest observations and takeaways from this year's tour? And were there any surprises compared to what participants were expecting heading into this year's tour?
We had pretty low expectations starting the tour. We had been in a bad drought in the Central Plains, not just Kansas, but Texas, Colorado, Oklahoma, where we had number one, early warm weather in March. It was really warm and hot in the central southern plains. We got to 100 degrees in March in Kansas. And then we had some extreme cold episodes after that. So number one, we knew the wheat crop was well ahead of schedule, at least 2 or 3 weeks ahead of schedule. Number two, we knew that it was going to be a smaller wheat crop. I think there was a little bit of shock in just how bad the wheat was in some parts of the state. It's going to be a really small wheat crop, not only in Texas, Oklahoma, and Colorado, but in Kansas. Back in 2023, not too long ago, we had a very small crop, and this one is going to rival that. We're only projecting, around 218, 220 million bushels of production in Kansas this year. Last year it was 346 million bushels, so we're two-thirds of what we'd like to see for a normal wheat crop in the state of Kansas.
So speaking of this year's crop being smaller, I think it was a couple months ago now, the USDA's 2026-2027 WASDE report projected one of the smallest U.S. wheat crops in decades. So how does that forecast align with what you're hearing from Kansas wheat growers and what challenges farmers are facing as they work through this crop year?
Well, farmers are out in the field right now, and they are harvesting the crop, and so we're starting to see reality come into the bin, so to speak. And yeah, it's going to be a small crop. That WASDE report is spot on. This is going to be one of the smallest hard red winter wheat crops in the United States in a long time. And so Obviously, that has implications for farmers. They're already facing pretty stressing financial times. Input costs have been very high. The cost of fertilizer they need to put on that wheat crop was pretty high, and so they're not getting a good return on that investment. It has implications for our international and domestic customers. There's not going to be a huge supply of hard red winter wheat from the United States on the marketplace this year. So we'll see how exports go. We're always able to meet our customers' expectations, but there might be a few challenges this year.
So while we are in a crop year that is marked by production challenges and tighter supplies, what resources and research efforts, or just priorities in general, is Kansas Wheat focusing on to support wheat growers to help position the industry for long-term success?
Well, what we can do is really continue the path we're going down, and what we've always done is focus on research to improve wheat varieties for challenging weather years like this year. And frankly, the good genetics do actually prove out on a year like this, as little rainfall as some of the states have had, even parts of western Kansas having as little as 2 inches of rainfall on a wheat crop since it got planted last fall, and it's still producing grain. So it's some really amazing genetics that it's even has that capacity to do that. But we continue to, work on research to improve the varieties that can get through drought and can get through heat. This just was an extreme side of the scale. And then we just work with organizations like NOG on the regulatory front. The farm bill has some critical components in it. That farm safety net is just insurance is just essential on years like this. It's what keeps those farmers going because they're losing money per acre on wheat. And so having that representation at the national level is definitely something we need to keep going forward.
So, trying to look ahead to a more optimistic view. So, what are you the most optimistic about for Kansas wheat, and what should farmers and industry holders be paying attention to over the next several months?
Well, the challenge is as we head into planting season, which is not that far away. We're harvesting wheat here early in the year. We started wheat harvests before Memorial Day in Kansas, which has only happened a couple other times in my memory. As we head towards planting season, farmers are going to keep an eye on the wheat price, what the wheat price is, what the weather conditions are, what their crop rotation is. So there are a lot of variables that factor into their planting decisions. They're going to be paying attention to input costs. What are fertilizer costs going to look like in a few months? Global conflicts like Iran are having some impact on those. So unfortunately, there's a lot of unknowns that wheat farmers have to deal with. What I'm optimistic about is the resiliency of wheat farmers. They know the importance of putting winter wheat in a crop rotation. They don't look at one crop, they look at the whole holistic system, and know winter wheat plays a role in making all the crops in that crop rotation better. So I'm optimistic that we are starting to have rain right now, which is bad timing for harvest, but we do need the rain in Kansas to eat away at the drought, so we have good planting conditions this fall.
I'm here at the National Wheat Foundation's annual farm tour with Chairman Scott Brown, an Idaho farmer. Scott, can you give us an overview of this year's tour and tell us who is participating?
Yeah, this year's tour is much like tours in the past, where we bring individuals that are interested in wheat farming and agriculture to an actual working farm. And this year we came to Eric Spade's farm. We've come here many times before, but Eric is always a gracious host, and we come here and we tour the wheat farm, and we also have a panelist of people from NRCS, FSA, RMA, and other people. The participants this year are members of congressional staff. We have some RMA people, some folks from NRCS. We have some ag attaché people. Just a lot of a different, lot, a diverse group of people.
So why does the National Wheat Foundation continue to invest in hosting this event year after year?
Well, it's one of our missions, I guess, for the foundation is to educate. And this is an educational event to let people see a wheat farm in action and to learn more about wheat production and what wheat farmers actually do. At the start of the tour, I had people raise their hands if they'd ever been on a wheat farm, and it's surprising the number of people that haven't been on a wheat farm. And so it's just an opportunity for us to educate people that make our policies, people that are involved in the administration of the farm bill and other things. It gives them an opportunity to come and actually see a wheat farm and get that education.
What do you see as the biggest benefit of bringing this broad coalition of agriculture leaders, policymakers, researchers, and industry stakeholders to a working wheat farm during harvest?
Well, I think you know, in addition to the education and the things that they learn here on the farm, I think they develop relationships, and you know, those relationships are important down the road when questions arise in their line of work about wheat farming or what wheat farming is all about, or just questions about farming in general. They have a resource that they can go to by making acquaintances with the people that are here today.
So after we leave the farm here today, what do you hope participants return to their organizations and take away from this experience? And how do you hope that this will help advance the wheat industry's priorities in the coming months and years ahead?
Well, I hope they take the education and the knowledge that they've gained and that they share that with other people. You know, in today's world, most people think that our food comes from the supermarket, not from the family farm. And so I hope they take that knowledge and education and share it with family and coworkers and other people they work with to explain, you know, where their food comes from and why it's important to support agriculture and be involved in just spreading the word about how our food is raised.
Thank you for listening to the May-June podcast. Make sure to keep up with us on social media and our website at wheatworld.org.